Good morning. Today is Friday, July 31st. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Carolyn Walsh, and I will be reading from the Boston Globe magazine, which was published on July 26th. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. The feature article is The Hidden Life of Conley Terminal. It's a slice of blue-collar Boston and the heart of New England's economy, by Danny McDonald. Some 200 feet above the South Boston waterfront, Richard Callahan is listening to thumping box music in the cab of a massive crane. Working with joysticks and knobs, he directs the machine to pluck containers off of a ship at a dizzying distance below. That vessel, the MSC Bridgeport, is just in from Europe after stops in Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, and France. The black-and-white hulled ship is a behemoth longer than three football fields. For those who work at the Paul W. Conley Container Terminal, it's just another July morning at the office, but what happens here is a modern engineering marvel. Everything is at scale. The crane Callahan is operating weighing 2,900 tons, costs over $14 million, and can hoist 65 tons of containers in one move. The ship, meanwhile, can hold 4,000 40-foot containers. It's a lot of stuff. Conley is far from the biggest port in the country, and in parentheses, the Port of Los Angeles handles the most imports, according to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics, close quotes. Still, official touted as the only full-service port in the region, with an average of 200 cargo ships docking here annually, carrying a total of 130,000 to 140,000 containers. Each arrival is a sight to behold as goods from around the world, furniture, granite slabs, Italian wines, Dunkin' cups, stock for discount stores, chains, you name it, are hauled away to destinations mostly across New England and upstate New York. There are also exports, such as lumber from Maine and calamari from Rhode Island, headed overseas. Callahan doesn't know what's in the containers and isn't particularly interested. And in parentheses, the cargo this day includes water sports equipment, building materials, manufacturing machinery, and wine and beer, according to the Massachusetts Port Authority, which operates the terminal, close quotes. He has been working here for 33 years, and for him, it's the real-life game of Tetris. The force of moving freight boxes as effectively he can. I love running the crane, and that's in quotation marks, says Callahan, 51. Again, quoting, I'm always in competition with myself to see if I beat what I did last week, close quotes. Conley Terminal is a study in contradictions, a hub for trade with far-flung locales, Singapore, China, Panama. It's also as local as it gets, running thanks to people such as Callahan, a union longshoreman originally from South Boston with no college education, who lived in Section 8 housing and once survived on welfare. It's a slice of old, blue-collar Boston, tucked into a corner of what's left of the working waterfront. Named after a union longshoreman from Southie, it stands in stark contrast to the gleaming developments nearby in the seaport, where cocktails can run $20 and you can pay $40 for the privilege of playing ping pong for an hour. The terminal is also a mystery for many Bostonians, despite being in plain view. The terminal's shore cranes, with their telescopic booms or arms sticking out parallel with the pier, are a familiar sight for those flying in and out of Logan International Airport or strolling around Castle Island. The gargantuan machines evoke something otherworldly, like the Empire's military walkers in Star Wars. For curious people, there's also all the access you're likely to get. There are checkpoints and special clearances needed to walk the docks where all the action is. Federal customs agents play an important role here. It's a place you won't see in any tourist brochures. All of this invites the question, what does go on at Conley? That inquiry is why, on a hot summer's day, I find myself riding around the expanse of port in an SUV with Max Wigglesworth, Conley's director. No 2 days are the same. No 2 ships are the same, Wigglesworth tells me as we drive past seemingly endless stacks of yellow, blue, red, and white containers. Trucks sit idling, waiting for containers to be dropped onto their beds. A light breeze carries a tinge of brine with it off the channel, and every now and then a seagull flaps overhead. Wigglesworth seems to know every inch of the terminal's 130 acres, including things not visible to most. With Logan just across the water, he explains, a flight path cuts diagonally through the terminal, creating a demarcation line. To the left of it, the terminal doesn't need to notify Logan to use the cranes. To the right, it does. Wigglesworth, a 37-year-old North Shore native who still lives there, knows the line down to the foot. Hard hats are required while the cranes are operating, Wigglesworth said. It won't do you much good if a 30-ton box drops on you, but could protect you if a metal washer falls from 200 feet up. For Wigglesworth, it's not what's in the containers that makes the port remarkable. You work with a lot of great men and women that are in the blue-collar positions, and I'd argue that those are the best types of people to work with, he says. Imagine your office was atop the Bunker Hill Monument that's just about the height at which Richard Callahan works. Callahan is showing me around his crane's cab, which is the size of the interior of an SUV and looks like something out of a 1970s sci-fi movie. A lot of analog, but somehow futuristic at the same time. There are knobs and buttons, monitors, and foot pedals. There is nothing but glass beneath the chair where he sits. To get up here, I took the elevator. The view is vertigo-inducing, 210 feet straight down to the pavement. Callahan invites me to use a joystick to move the spreader, the part of the crane that attaches to box containers, assuring me that the safety settings make it impossible to do any damage. I oblige, moving the spreader up and down. Sure enough, when it gets close to the ground, it slows down before it stops. Callahan likes techno music, particularly the stylings of DJ Dan, Frankie Bones, and Bad Boy Bill. He used to attend raves, and after giving up drugs and alcohol in 1998, took up DJing, teaching himself how to work turntables. He gigged around town, but eventually realized he was making too much money as a crane operator. He says it's commonplace for crane operators to make north of $200,000 to stay out late spinning tunes. Sometimes a particularly robust load will make the crane's arm flex like a diving board and move the cab with it, Callahan tells me. He doesn't think about what could go wrong, he says, adding that he has never witnessed a box dropped from the crane since he started working here as an 18-year-old, though firefighters did have to rescue a crane operator who got stranded in a storm earlier this year. There are incredible vistas from the crane of downtown Boston, the harbor, the airport, and Southie. Callahan, the son of a single mother who worked at a mental health facility on Long Island, points out the apartment buildings he spent part of his youth in. They lived on the first floor, while his grandfather, a longshoreman who Callahan got into the union in this line of work, lived on the seventh. Talk about gratitude, dude, he says. That union card alone was worth it all. Looking down at the waterfront, it's hard not to think about Boston's storied maritime history, including the mob that, in 1773, dumped tea into the harbor to protest British legislation granting a monopoly to the East India Company. In response, authorities closed the port, strangling the city's commercial activities. Back down on the docks, however, Conley doesn't call to mind angry men in tricorn hats. Here, international trade flows freely. It's a highly orchestrated affair with a simple purpose, to move goods from sea to shore and vice versa. Active since World War II, then called Castle Island Terminal, much thought and considerable investment has been put into streamlining operations over the years. Tidal variations used to have a much larger impact on when and what types of ships could dock, but a $350 million dredging of the harbor that wrapped in 2022 means that the tides have much less to say in the day-to-day operations. A huge bowl in the floor of the harbor, 1,700 feet in diameter and 47 feet deep, allows the massive ships to turn near the dock. All told, Massport has invested nearly $850 million over the last decade to modernize the port, including Clonley, and ensuring that it is big ship ready, as officials put it. Security is tight here. Customs officers can open up containers right on the docks or use an X-ray machine. And in parentheses, yes, big enough for a 40-foot container to fit inside, close parentheses, to examine them. There are sensors that read truck license plates and those that read serial numbers on the containers. Cameras capture trucks from nearly every angle. Scales weigh cargo containers that enter the terminal, a required safety precaution. Still, interesting things happen whenever the sea meets the shoreline, and Clonley is no different. Authorities have caught stowaways here as recently as 2024. In 2007, illegal shipments of U.S. military night vision goggles were seized as they were being smuggled to the Middle East. Around the same time, a collection of stolen motorcycles, a lot of photos in this article, flipping pages, stolen motorcycles was nabbed before it reached the Azores. Barry O'Brien, a 62-year-old mechanic who has worked here for decades, is walking around on top of a crane, explaining its components, the cables, rollers, and flippers, which help the spreader clamp onto boxes. At times, he has to strain to be heard over a mechanical whirr as the crane's cables move up and down. Like Callahan, O'Brien is a multi-generational union longshoreman who's been sober for years, whose Southie accent is not so much heard as experienced. And once upon a time, he was a city kid. He spends some of his time 240 feet above ground, puttering around walkways atop the cranes as if they were his living room. In winter, icicles falling from these structures sound like wine bottles smashing on the pavement below. I figure if I fall, I'm not going to feel anything anyways, he jokes. If something breaks on a crane, it's O'Brien's job to fix it. Sometimes that means being raised in a bucket to switch out a roller on a boom. Other times, it's something as simple as greasing the crane's various parts or swapping out a waterlogged fuel filter on some machine in the yard. Excuse me. You realize the importance of the job, he says. Without our end of it, there's no import-export. That came into sharp relief in 2024, when unionized longshoremen along the East Coast, including 300 workers in Boston, went on a three-day strike seeking better pay and protections against automation taking their jobs. Fully automated ports exist elsewhere in the world, but people who work at Clonley are adamant that humans are still faster than machines. For now, there are still solid jobs, allowing workers such as O'Brien to pay college tuition for their kids and maybe afford a vacation home. After work, O'Brien heads home to Westwood, a suburb where he winds down by taking walks with his dog, a cockapoo named after New England Patriots Hall of Fame linebacker Andre Tippett. We just wanted a good-paying job, he says, of the people working at the docks. And they're few and far between now, I think, if you don't have a college education. Some morning, 200 trucks, the kind of tractor trailers you see on Interstate 93 or the Mass Pike, line up at various checkpoints around the port, ready to pick up or drop off. That's where Caitlin Miller comes in with her rubber-tired gantry crane, which, at 75 feet, is considerably smaller than the shore crane some of her colleagues operate. Its side-to-side movements looks crab-like as it loads boxes onto trucks. Even though they're dwarfed by the shore cranes, each of these machines still weighs 120 tons and costs $2 million. They run on cement slabs in the yard. Otherwise, the weight would wear grooves into the asphalt. These machines are known as cones, cones with a K, K-O-N-E-S, for their maker, Cone Cranes. Over the years, Miller, 38, has come to know the truckers that frequent Conley, who delivers job to businesses such as Jordan's Furniture and Ocean State Job Lot. But usually, she doesn't know what's in the boxes. The truckers care about speed more than anything, says Miller, a Quincy native whose grandfather was a longshoreman for a half century. They want to get their cargo loaded and go. It's super important, she says. After a ship, Miller's mind usually turns to shaking off the physical cobwebs of working in the cab for hours. She likes to work out and trains in jiu-jitsu. You're sitting a lot, she says, of the work. Your job is to sit in the chair and do the thing. That predictability is a far cry from Miller's time serving in Afghanistan with the Army National Guard. When she returned home from her overseas tour in late 2010, some of the alarms that sounded at Conley, where machines began moving, reminded her of take cover warnings she heard overseas. There's a lot of noises that can be unnerving when you first come back, she recalls with a laugh. Callahan claims he is the best crane operator in the port, despite admitting he was terrible at video games as a kid. Operating the crane with its buttons and knobs comes more naturally to him. This morning, though, there are challenges. He goes to lift some of the containers and finds some of the pins that fasten them to the ships are still there. Someone has failed to remove them. This means delays. When it comes time, though, Callahan and another crane operator move 10 containers in 12 minutes, locking into a steady rhythm. The spreader nestles on top of a box, and then it gets hoisted into the air. The crane swings the goods towards the dock, then lowers them out of view. Callahan dissects the work like a color commentator on a sports broadcast. He talks about how newer operators can struggle with depth perception from their perch, how learning to catch the swing of the crane is the most difficult facet of the job. On a good day, he can move 45 containers in an hour. Once, he said, he moved 306 hours of seat time. While he won't come close to those numbers this shift, he finds satisfaction in the work. The terminal has afforded him a good life, a house in Weymouth, a rental property he maintains on Lake Winnipesaukee, time to indulge in his pickleball addiction. His son, too, works on the waterfront. His grandfather worked the cranes until his mid-70s. Callahan hopes to be long retired by then. For now, he's content to pick up the container boxes and put them down out of sight of most Bostonians. A proud cog in the machine of the economy, global and local, over and over again. When I'm relieved and I'm walking to my truck, he says, that's the best feeling in the world. So there are a number of statistics that were spread across the pages in this article. So there are 100 to 175 number of employees working at Conley on a given day. 200, the approximate number of cargo ships that dock at Conley Terminal each year. 120,000, the average number of trucks that visit the port each year. 30, the average number of minutes a truck driver spends at Conley per visit. 65, number of tons of containers a shore crane at Conley can lift in one move. $850 million, which we had read earlier, that's the amount spent by Massport over the last decade to modernize the port of Boston, including Conley. They said there were numerous photos. The cranes, the structures of them, people climbing up to get into various aspects of the cranes, some nice shots of the Boston Harbor where, you know, the terminal is located. So the article was written by Danley McDonald. He is a Metro reporter for the Globe. So let's turn to the next major article. Excuse me. Provincetown loves stories. the author of The Hours on Falling in Love. This is by Michael Cunningham and the illustration by Jackson Joyce for the Boston Globe. Thomas and Joseph were men of indeterminate age, though they were both well into their 70s and possibly beyond. They often had people, many of us young men, over for brunch or cocktails or dinner. They never went out. Their house, on its rise overlooking Provincetown Harbor on Cape Cod, smelled of furniture polish and a clean, wintry residue, hints of snow and ice that the summers never quite scoured away. The rooms were not dark, but they were kept in a perpetual shade, arbored, dimmed. In the living room, an ancient upright piano sat piled with Hailback-sized stacks of yellowed sheet music. The bookshelves, crammed to capacity, overflowed into piles of books on the floor. Thomas and Joseph had lived there for almost 50 years. I was one of the several young men who were invited regularly to their brunches and dinners. I was always received with the frivolous intimacy that implied decades of friendship. And in parentheses, "Oh, my dear, get in here right this second." Even though I'd known them for less than a year, and like most young people who pass through Provincetown, would be leaving soon. I always arrived with a bottle of the least bad wine I could afford, wearing a paisley thrift store tuxedo jacket over T-shirt and jeans, the closest I had to formal wear. Thomas and Joseph, and in parentheses, never Tom, never Joe, they dressed like Connecticut housewives. Oversized white shirts and slacks at dinner. Sweatpants and polo shirts at brunch. They inhabited their own private hair reality. Joseph dyed his hair a color I can only call chipmunk. Thomas felt that a comb-over consisting of roughly 30 strands was preferable to baldness. They were gracious hosts and fantastic cooks. Food was their primary point of contact with the ongoing world. They had become experts at Northern Italian and Basque cooking. There was always a moment of disconnect when Thomas, the dominant force in the kitchen, emerged, comb-over in place, from a kitchen unaltered since 1960s, proudly beaming, carrying plates of brasato, albarolo, or cod basques, that would not have been surprising in a Michelin-starred restaurant. Thomas and Joseph, having dispatched one or two of the requisite stories, and in parentheses, cocktails with Tennessee Williams, the night Judy Garland belted out a few at the Atlantic Coast, close quotes, they were not given to further reminiscence. They wanted to know about me, particularly about my erotic adventures, which must sound exploitative and salacious, which it probably was, but Thomas and Joseph's effect was more of grandmothers than horny old men. I'd offer whatever tales I could muster. I exaggerated, sometimes to the point of fiction, though I always based them, however loosely, on actual experience, out of a nagging sense of obligation to the relative truth. In the stories, I emerged as an Alice in Wonderland figure. My overall tone could be called curiouser and curiouser. Among the tales I remember telling over the course of a year are, that's right, he was a high school teacher with a dungeon in his basement, derived from a night on which I declined to be handcuffed to a bed. He was the first drag queen in history. He looked even better as a girl. Based on a man who, on the night I met him, wore eyeliner and a pink wig. Thomas's and Joseph's responses were so grandmother-like. Oh, my, and I'm sorry to say that we didn't do those things like that in our day, that I remain unembarrassed still about evenings spent telling hyperbolized stories about myself, chronicles of a plucky, charming boy who always got lucky, who was never ignored by a handsome stranger, who never gotten halfway out of a bar with a boy who suddenly changed his mind, who never struck out and gone home wondering if those Chinese leftovers in the refrigerator were still okay to eat. A confession? I enjoyed being the person I was to Thomas and Joseph. It mattered that they were amused but never appalled. It was a chance for me to be shameless about a life considered, not only by grandmothers but by the majority of the population at large, to be shameful. If I conjured and briefly inhabited a lustier version of myself, I did it to hold their interest, and I did it to recreate myself, for myself as a romantic scoundrel, the 20-something I'd once hoped to become. I got to be that person approximately one night a week with Thomas and Joseph. I left that version of myself at their house, along with the sheet music and the books, the crackled mirror in the entranceway, and the collection of miniature globes they had amassed during their own youth. After my writing residency in Provincetown ended, I moved to New York. I'd learned that I didn't do well in small towns, however calming the mournful notes of a foghorn on the breakwater was. I was ready to meet artists and philosophers in bars and coffee houses, drag queens, political activists, movie stars, whomever. It was while I was living downtown that I met Ken Corbett, known to his friends as Kenny. Our meeting was so coincidental as to have led me to wonder how many lifelong relationships we might all miss because we went to the laundromat an hour too late because we left the party 20 minutes too early. I'd gone to Provincetown for the weekend. I was glad to go back during the summers when the town came to life again. I had a few friends who lived in town, Thomas and Joseph among them. They'd always invited me to dinners, which were precisely as they had always been, in the house so unaltered I could have sworn that the wooden spoon on the kitchen countertop had been there in that exact position when I was last there. Provincetown became my escape from New York. Ironically, in Provincetown during the summers, I met more intellectuals, drag queens, political activists, and movie stars than I had in New York. My friend David had opened a small art gallery on the east end of Commercial Street. The galleries of Provincetown tended almost exclusively to seascapes, floral still lives involving flowers that did not grow in or anywhere near Provincetown, and portraits of fishing boats. Amongst all that, David showed drawings of malformed mutants from the 23rd century, all black paintings encrusted with black sequins and abstracts and violent, clashing colors. Whenever I was in town, I'd sit with David in his gallery for an hour or two. As tourists approached, David and I would bet on how long it would be for them to take a quick look at the art and flee. A minute. I'd say more than 30 seconds. One of us was always right, until the day we saw a lithe, trimly handsome man in his early 30s coming toward the gallery. David said, "Last guy, this bought something." And I said, "Somebody bought something?" It was Kenny. We talked for almost an hour. He admired, but did not purchase, a drawing of a 23rd century mutant. Like me, he was visiting Provincetown from New York. He was smart and funny. He was cute, boyish, animated. He was possibly David's only customer ever. We had a good time together. We were effortlessly interested in each other. When Kenny and I met, I was dating someone back in New York. In Provincetown, my romance senses were turned off. I said goodbye to Kenny and didn't think much more about him beyond the fact that, although I had a boyfriend, some entity in the universe seemed to keep producing attractive, intelligent gay men I couldn't date. And then, when I got back to New York, the boy and I broke up, over dinner in an Italian restaurant. It was notably undramatic. Him, it sounds like P-Town was a lot of fun. Me, yeah, I'm sorry you couldn't come. It's such a buzzkill having a job. Him, it's the busy season. Me, I know. It was an ordinary conversation. That, I suppose, was the problem. 3 months in, and it was as if we'd just been introduced. I experienced a mini epiphany that night. The boy in question was attractive. He was nice enough, but I wasn't particularly interested in him or he in me. An aperture opened. I walked through it, drawing a pause in the conversation. Me. This isn't really working out, is it? Him. I guess maybe it isn't, really. We agreed that we'd skip dessert. after we'd left the restaurant, after we've said a brief, not unfriendly goodbye, I resisted, if only barely, the urge to turn around and run after him. You're great. I'm such a fool. It's just my fear of commitment. I sabotage things when I start to have feelings. It would at best be in the vicinity of the truth. If I had held to it, it might turn into the truth. I thought I'd call him when I got home. I decided I'd call him in the morning. I didn't call him in the morning. I never saw him again. In the morning, I called Kenny instead. Yes, I was an undergraduate. A professor told me that in fiction, if you depict people falling in love, you need a falling in love moment, which could be anything from a shared devotion to an obscure musician to catching a glimpse of the other at a moment when they don't realize they're being watched, the sensation of witnessing them in their privacy. What the professor meant was, apply that weariest of maxims, show, don't tell, not only to the dance hall chandelier or a lightning storm in a desert, but to an experience as ineffable as the inception of love. Years ago, Kenny and I got caught in a storm. It was mid-April, one of the New York City days that was technically early spring, but was in reality locked into a seemingly endless condition of late winter, with a low, steel-colored sky and scraps of sooty snow still plastered to the curbs. We were blocks from our apartment when a rainstorm blew in, as suddenly as if somebody, somehow, had hastily cranked the rain dial from zero to high. By the time we reached Washington Square Park, which was shallowly filled with opaque brown water, we didn't dwell on what must have been in that water. We couldn't have gotten any wetter. Drapes of rain blew noisily across the plaza, and, for a touch of the surreal, the fountain in the center was gushing, about 50 feet high, so that Kenny and I were passing through a sequestered world of water where it flowed both up and down. I don't remember which of us held out his arms for a dance. It probably doesn't matter. What I do remember is the conviction that each of us had the same idea at the same moment. We waltzed, I awkward but ardent, Kenny suavely practiced as we were battered by rain. This was not, however, our falling in love moment. It was too obvious. It contained too much of, here we are dancing in the rain. When we got home, we fell into spasms of laughter, the laughter born of relief that you've survived catastrophes, both major and minor, intensified for us by the way in which our minuscule apartment, with its air shaft views and its bathtub for the kitchen, felt for a few minutes like a sanctuary, a demonstration of our good fortune, which was not the impression it made on a more regular basis. The apartment was ludicrously inexpensive by New York City standards, because it was a sixth-floor walk-up, because its windows opened onto an air shaft, and because it was only slightly larger than the interior of a 1960s Oldsmobile. It was, for all its limitations, a lucky break for us. Kenny hadn't yet finished graduate school. I was living on what little I made from freelance journalism. On that stormy day, we peeled off our soaked clothes and got towels from our only shelf. We were joyfully content. We had been delivered into a place that, however generally inadequate, was warm and dry. Kenny toweled my chest. I had him turn around so I could towel his back. I thought suddenly of an old black-and-white photo I'd seen. Kenny, at the age of 4, freshly emerged from a bath. His mother was drying him off with a towel. The photo had been taken in the glare of a flashbulb, which gave Kenny's mother a strangely glamorous black-slipped smile, a black page boy in a skin as pale as a forest nymph's. In the photo, Kenny is laughing with the pure delight particular to young children. There he is with his mother, wrapped in a warm, dry towel in the bathroom of a tidy Midwestern house that will do, for his purposes, as the world itself. As I dried Kenny's back with its constellation of moles on the right-hand shoulder blade, which I called his personal Pleiades, I fell into a wormhole. I was in the present, in our apartment, and in the past, standing behind Kenny's father when he snapped the shutter so simultaneously that the difference between the past and present was rendered negligible. I entered both presents, one of which was occurring decades earlier, in the house in Illinois. I whispered to Kenny, "I'm here, I'm waiting. You'll be as loved in the future as you are right now." It ended in a moment. I didn't see at the time, but I see now, that when I crossed the love line, that was when I crossed the love line. That was when I first understood that whatever awaited Kenny and me, he could never again become unimportant. Thomas and Joseph, my friends from Cape Cod, died decades ago, within 6 months of each other. I wrote notes for a short story about them, but when I'd finished the first draft, it struck me as a violation of our shared privacy. I was protecting them and myself. I wouldn't have rendered them, not entirely, as the clever, cultured roués they'd prefer to be. Thomas and Joseph lived so long, contentedly and companionably, in a snug house with a garden and a view, which suited them, but which, when they were younger, had meant choosing between that and more public lives, in which they'd have posed as aging bachelors, or, had they been less discreet, would have risked their lives if they went out together after dark. There was no way of knowing whether they'd aspire to their days and nights of gardening, reading, and throwing intimate little dinner parties for young men, or whether they've adapted to the less onerous of their options. The following is a draft of a story I didn't publish. Thomas and Joseph's ashes were strewn over their garden almost 50 years ago. I'm still alive, and I barely resemble the boy they knew, who arrived in a ratty tuxedo jacket, ready to tell them all manner of sexy stories that could just as well have been true. Two elderly men have been living together for decades in a shingled house on a hilltop from which they can see the tops of the birch forest and beyond the forest, the shimmer of the Atlantic. Excuse me. They're as married to their routines as they are to each other. The morning eggs and toast, the walk in the garden, the afternoon nap, the preparation of elaborate dinners. They have agreed never to descend to the convenient or to the microwavable. Each is always searching out new recipes to make up for the other. Reading and cooking are new recipes to make for the other. In sleep, one always slings his arm over the chest of the other. As it turns out, one of them died a while ago, and the other has stayed to keep the ghost of his loved one's company. He holds the other's hand consolingly, assures him that he's not alone. We come to understand, though, that they're both dead. Each believes himself to be alive and attending to the other. One of the dead men drapes a crocheted blanket over the other, who's fallen asleep on the couch after dinner. The other man still keeps a small bunch of wildflowers in a drinking glass on the bedside table. Eventually, they'll begin to fade, though each will think it's happening only to the other. For reasons they can't explain, neither of them mentions it. It seems somehow indiscreet, even unkind. Each of them knows that their time together has always been limited. Each of them dreads the prospect of a life alone, here in the house. What will he do when he wakes up alone? They both fade away during an afternoon nap. Each of them knows that the other is about to vanish. Neither of them speaks, though they do take each other's hands. Michael Cunningham is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Hours and a professor of creative writing at Yale University. This excerpt is adapted from his new book, Unsayable, copyright 2026, by Mare Vaporum Corporation. It was published on July 21st, 2026, by Random House, an imprint and division of Penguin Random House, LLC. So, excuse me. Another article. This is called Up Front. I just want my life to be happy again. Is it really camping? by Courtney Humphreys. When I tell people about my family's annual camping trip with friends at Nickerson State Park on Cape Cod, I mentally put camping in air quotes. You see, I grew up in a hiking and backpacking family. Leaving our car in the parking lot, we'd begin walking, carrying everything we needed for a few days in a creaky metal frame backpack. Our cramped tent barely fit in my dad, my brother, and me. In the morning, we ate packaged oatmeal out of cups and then drank hot cocoa in the same cups to wash the leftover bits of oats out. When we did car camp, I could look forward to the luxury of fishing a can of soda out of a watery cooler at the end of the day. Even then, we almost never stayed at a large campground. For my dad, the point was to get as far into the wilderness as possible. An encounter with another human felt like a failure. This austere approach let me see places in the Southwest where I grew up that showed few signs of civilization. I spent nights along quiet New Mexican streams at the bottom of the Grand Canyon and lying on tops under a spinning canopy of stars in Utah's Canyonlands National Park. So when I first showed up at Nickerson several years ago, I was taken aback. The popular campground near the Cape Cod Rail Trail has closely packed campsites, bathrooms with showers, playground, and a camp store. My friends pitched spacious tents and cooked multi-course dinners from camping kitchens they had brought. Every night was a campfire with s'mores and music. A grocery store sat 2 miles down the road. On days we didn't feel like roughing it, we could head out to a restaurant or museum. It was a blast. But was it camping? I'm aware my personal definition of camping is shaped by experiences that are increasingly rare. National parks and even parts of wilderness areas are overrun, and to many, camping is no longer just sleeping in a tent and being close to nature. Camping equipment is a growing $22 billion industry, according to one market analysis. You can still outfit yourself in minimal gear for a few hundred bucks, or you can invest thousands in high-tech espresso makers, gadgets, and glamping furniture. At Nickerson, I see families in RVs decked out with patio sets and outdoor lights. Some campgrounds offer arcades, swimming pools, and cabins. The Outdoor Foundation doesn't even try to define camping, hedging a decade ago that it encompasses the spirit of escaping everyday life to embrace the outdoors. After several summer seasons joining my friends at Nickerson, I've gradually relinquished my minimalism. My family invested in new gear, limited only by the modest capacity of our Honda Fit. A huge tent, a canopy tent to shade out our site's picnic table, a full cook set, cushier sleeping pads, and a big camping chairs. We found a solar charge battery that lets my husband stay connected to his business so he can stay longer. I've also gained an appreciation for camping as a communal outdoor experience. Our stays are less about being in the wilderness and more about escaping some of the strictures of everyday life. Strolling through the campground, I can chat with a friend whom it would normally take weeks of planning to meet for dinner. My daughter is growing up with a very different camping experience compared to mine. To her, it's about swimming in a pond all afternoon, having the freedom to explore without parents, and buying candy at the camp store with her own money. But even as I've embraced this new approach, a question still nags me. Clearly, we all define camping differently along a spectrum between comfort and deprivation. But is there a point at which it isn't camping anymore? Does a line need to be drawn? Last summer, we spent a night in a yurt at another campground in Wellfleet. As sheets of rain poured down, I looked at the tents huddled in deepening puddles. I was relieved to be in a dry shelter, free from the stress of a soggy tent. But I also thought back to the night when I was a kid in a similar rainstorm. I tried to sleep while scooting closer to the center of a small tent as water filled its corners. When camping is too comfortable, as it was for me watching the rain fall outside our yurt, it's less memorable. After all, the story of my friends retell the most about Nickerson is about the night lightning struck the campground. Our tent sprang a leak, and the friend's campsite turned into a small lake. My childhood trips weren't about enjoyment, end quotes, as I grumbled to my dad on every long hike. Deprivation was intended feature. The goal wasn't to carry all the trappings of our lifestyle into the wilderness. It was to be adaptable enough to experience something different. When I'd had to lug my own stuff, I quickly learned that a small paperback, a notebook, and a pen were enough to keep me entertained for a few days. Long hikes showed me a well of physical resilience. I'd run on numerous times in my adult life. Untethered from the web of objects I've come to depend on, my own presence felt clearer and more substantial. Every camper needs to draw the line somewhere, whether that means carrying something on your back or leaving more stuff behind. Otherwise, you'll drift along a constant creep of convenience that will take you further away from what you were looking for in the first place. And by then, you may as well book a hotel room. As I began prepping for our annual visit to Nickerson recently, I looked through my old equipment and found the small backpacking stove my dad bought me years ago when I moved to the East Coast. It's never been used. But when my daughter is old enough to heft some gear, we'll venture somewhere a little more remote. Courtney Humphreys writes about science and the urban environment on Substack and The Nature We Make. So our last article for today, Connections, The Last Word, by Angela Yazbek. When my father was admitted to the hospital, I knew he wouldn't be leaving. I took the first flight home to find him confused, paranoid, fragile. The man who once loomed so large was now exposed and armorless, a paper-thin gown clinging to his emaciated frame. I had long since given up hope that we'd ever revisit our tumultuous past or that he'd apologize for his part in it. Seeing him so lost, I was even more convinced that day would never come. My siblings and I were born in Canada to Lebanese parents. I'd been navigating the no-man's land between two cultures my entire life. I was raised on a steady diet of fear and guilt. My father's apprehension that I'd be led astray by what he saw as permissive Western values, and my shame for wanting what scared him, dating, freedom, and Saturday night parties like the other kids in our white middle-class neighborhood. I could never be the daughter he wanted. So we fought, like two scorpions in a bottle, my father and I seized, yelling and slamming doors like nobody's business. We were a Middle East peace talk, unable to meet each other where we stood. At 23, I left home for a promising job in a big city and built a life my father was proud of, a successful career, marriage, and four grandsons who brought him great joy. He was happy, but I wasn't. In therapy, I unraveled what had made my relationship with Dad so fraught, peeling the proverbial onion, excavating every feeling I'd ever smothered. 2 decades of work, and still, I couldn't let the past go. Eventually, I came to realize my father wouldn't be around forever. Having reached his early 70s, he was slowing down. The man who used to power walk 45 minutes daily had become less stable on his feet. As his mobility worsened, it became clear that this was more than simple aging. The diagnosis, Parkinson's disease. "I feel like I'm in prison," he confided one morning, gazing into the distance. "I know a thing or two about losing battles you couldn't win. I had been there. We both had." Months later, Dad was diagnosed with terminal cancer. In his hospital room, he opened his eyes to find me at his bedside. His face crumbled. "I've been carrying something in my heart," he said, each syllable heavy with anguish, "for so long." He blinked away the tears rimming his large, almond eyes. I felt my own heart squeeze tight. I didn't recognize this man who was crying, vulnerable, raw. For the first time, I truly saw my father, and maybe, finally, he saw me. The truth spilled out. I'm sorry. I was stunned. The two words I'd longed for my entire life, hoped against hope to hear, and believed would bring healing, closure, and freedom. We all do our best, I wept. Love you, Dad. 4 weeks later, he died, and the doubts began creeping in. Instead of leaving me reassured, his apology gnawed at me. Sorry for what? My father had been in and out of delusions. He was dying, his mind blurred by illness. As I wrestled with this, any sense of closure was replaced by an unrelenting question. Did he even know what he was apologizing for? My need for an explanation became its own kind of prison. Who, as my father often said, or why, did I have to question everything? You would have made a great lawyer, he'd said. You'd always have to get the last word. What I finally realized was understanding wasn't the same as peace. I didn't need one to find the other. Maybe it was time to let him have the last word, to accept his intention, even if the circumstances weren't perfect. So I did, and for once, I didn't need to answer back. I spent my life waiting for him to apologize, only to realize the real change came from forgiving him. Angela Yazbek is a writer in Toronto. So we have a few minutes here. This is Lifestyle, and it features, this is a regular feature in the Boston Globe magazine. It features a living room that has been beautifully recreated. It's called A Sunny Delight. Unexpected colors and vintage furnishings. It transforms a sunroom into an all-season retreat. Kate Discalculus's client was certain in the sunroom in her 1960s split-level home in Framingham could do more. After installing a mini-split system and insulating the floor and ceiling for year-round use, she hired Discalculus to rethink the decor. She wanted a collected aesthetic with mid-century elements, as the founder of KSD Designs and the gallery on Federal Art Showroom on Newburyport, The homeowner's vintage wrought iron dining set was the starting point. Fabulous, but now also challenging given the color, a zesty lime green. Not wanting to skew preppy, she steered clear of pink. Instead, she opted for burgundy. The burgundy and green color combination feels elevated and sophisticated. So the photo shows a new rug. It's a grid of florals based upon a vintage Swedish sheet, archival papers with pressed plants used by botanists. The second piece that the photo shows is a vintage faux bamboo table in aged brass. The third piece, a vintage wicker floor lamp with Art Deco vibes that lets the owner enjoy the room in the evening, too. The silhouette creates a sun hat, which plays off the garden theme, the designer says. The fourth addition to this sunroom, vintage rattan chairs from Portland Flea for All in Maine replace bulky ones that ate up floor space. Sheepskins on top of these chairs adds a cozy factor and ruffled pillows. The fifth addition is off-the-shelf drapery in a wide, painterly stripe, and this lends a French cabana sensibility to the room, which overlooks the owner's gardens. We left them long enough to puddle on the floor for a more relaxed feel. Number six in this scene, seat cushions. They are in a French lilac, and it's a choice color that pulls in the colors of the rug, and the pattern on the seat cushions doesn't interfere with the rug or swooping lines of the furniture. So that is the finish of today. There are some other articles that Maybe we can catch up with next week. There's always the article about the big day. This one is quite long. It's the marriage of a couple, and a little grace helps them overcome some loss. So I said maybe we can read that next week. Anyways, in closing, you are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Thank you.
These are the death notices for Friday, July 31st. Of Arlington, John F. Westwater. Of Bedford, Howard Albert Emerson. Of Beverly, Jacqueline Galuzzi. Of Boston, Hoyt Austin. Teresa McIsaac Curran. John D. Hamilton. Paula Hamilton. Claire Midgley. Rosemary Rosie Miller Ryan. Dr. Richard Neal Woolman. Joseph David Zola. Of Bourne, Anne M. Struzik Shores. Of Brighton, Teresa McIsaac Curran. Of Brookline, James P. Mackey III. Of Cambridge, Eric C. Krasuski. Of Canton, Janet L. Pratt. Of Concord, John D. Hamilton, Paula Hamilton. Of Dedham, Joan E. Lang Keith, Rosemary Rosie Miller Ryan. Of Everett, John F. Westwater. Of Franklin, Kathleen Kathy McDonough Hines. Of Jamaica Plain, Kathleen Kathy McDonough Hines. Rosemary Rosie Miller Ryan. Of Lexington, Eric C. Krasuski. Of Medfield, Ernestine C. Body Lupo. Of Medford, Edmund L. Angeli Jr. John F. Westwater. Of Millis, Ernestine C. Body Lupo. Of Milton, Mary Claire Curran Cuniff. Of Nahant, Richard P. D'Orlando. Of Nantucket, John D. Hamilton, Paula Hamilton, Joan E. Lang Keith. Of Needham, Joan E. Lang Keith, Ernestine C. Body Lupo. Of Newton, Eric C. Krasuski, Claire Midgley. Of Norwood, Janet L. Pratt, Joseph David Zola. Of Orleans, James P. Mackey III. Of Osterville, Ernestine C. Body Lupo. Of Plainville, Joseph David Zola. Of Quincy, Mary Claire Curran Cuniff, Thomas Robert Masters, John Patrick Needham, William A. Bill O'Shea. Of Revere, Joseph David Zola. Of Roslindale, Kathleen Kathy McDonough Hines. Of South Boston, Mary Claire Curran Cuniff, John Patrick Needham. Of South Dartmouth, Hoyt Austin. Of Tewksbury, Edmund L. Angeli Jr. Of Walpole, Joseph David Zola. Of Watertown, Eric C. Krasuski. Of Wellesley, Joan E. Lang Keith, Ernestine C. Body Lupo. Of West Bridgewater, Kathleen Kathy McDonough Hines. Of West Roxbury, Teresa McIsaac Curran, Kathleen Kathy McDonough Hines, Rosemary Rosie Miller Ryan. Of Westwood, Rosemary Rosie Miller Ryan. And of Winthrop, Richard P. D'Orlando. This concludes the death notices for Friday, July 31st.
This is the Chef of Love, Chef Gennard, TV host and restaurateur. My grandparents harvested their land to sell food and share this overflowing bounty with our community. Grandma said, for every yam we pick, we give one away. In the world they cultivated, I love preparing and eating dinner with my family on Sundays. When our resources changed, food assistance programs sustained us. They gave me fuel to